And Ms. Farber, we'll hear from you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sarah Jessica Farber, and I represent Larry Waddell in this action. Mr. Waddell is one of around 130 inmates incarcerated in North Carolina's Department of Correction who was sentenced under North Carolina General Statute 14-2. 14-2 was in effect from April 8, 1974 to July 30, 1978. It read, in pertinent part, a sentence of life imprisonment shall be considered as a sentence of imprisonment for a term of 80 years in the state's prison. Though the statute seems straightforward, the North Carolina Department of Correction did not treat persons sentenced under 14-2 as having 80-year sentences. Rather, they treated them as life sentences, states brief at 2. The state, however, was wrong to have done so. And the North Carolina Court of Appeals clarified this in State versus Bowdoin. That case held that life imprisonment in 14-2 meant 80 years for all purposes without any limitation or restriction. This opinion was issued on October 9, 2009, and the mandate issued on October 29, 2009. This is the date the DOC's long-standing mistake of law was judicially rectified. And on that date, the DOC should have released Mr. Waddell.
Now, that's the Bowdoin case?
Yes, sir.
That was by the Court of Appeals, though.
That was by the Court of Appeals. The North Carolina Supreme Court granted review and then determined that review was improvidently granted. So when that opinion came down on the 9th, essentially affirming the Court of Appeals' opinion, that's the date we're using. Does that make sense?
But they later changed it. They later repudiated that ruling, didn't they?
Well, Jones v. Keller did not overrule State versus Bowdoin. It purported to apply it.
Well,
and when it applied it, the people in the same class as your client, they said that he doesn't get any relief.
They did, and that was the wrong conclusion because their analysis created an entirely new due process analysis. Rather than applying a straightforward procedural due process
analysis.
And
that's the Supreme Court of North Carolina.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the highest court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the Court of Appeals is the intermediate court.
Yes. Rather than applying a straightforward due process analysis, whether substantive or procedural, they crafted a new...
Was certiorari to the United States Supreme Court requested in that case?
It was, and it was not granted. And their new due process analysis created out of whole cloth.
What was Jones, about a year after Bowdoin?
Yes, Your Honor. It's completely new. So it's not only not an application of the established federal law, which is controlling on due process questions, but it misapplies the law that's there and crafts a new policy. This is something that the state court is not empowered to do. And by adopting...
Under AEDPA, we're obligated to, well, we have to identify the state, if there's been a state court ruling, the state court decision that's involved, and then we give deference to it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The state court decision here that's involved in this case, is that Jones?
Yes, Your Honor. The North Carolina Supreme Court denied habeas relief to Mr. Waddell, and Mr. Waddell filed a habeas petition in the North Carolina Supreme Court.
That was based on Jones.
That was based on Jones, and both
Even
parties
it
agree.
Say so.
Exactly. Both parties agree that Jones is.
Everybody agrees Jones is the state court decision that we're looking at.
Yes. Yes. However, Jones didn't. Not only did Jones not apply the clearly established federal law correctly, it was objectively unreasonable in its application because federal due process law is pretty clear. When a state awards good time credits for satisfactory behavior while an inmate is in prison, an inmate's interest in those credits has real substance. It's sufficiently embraced within the 14th Amendment concept of liberty to entitle the inmate to those minimum procedures appropriate under the circumstances being the prison context, to ensure that that state-created right is not arbitrarily abrogated. And that did not happen here.
Well,
not
only the district court said that on one part of its ruling, that under AEDPA, your client was time barred.
Yes, Your Honor.
So tell us why that's incorrect.
Gladly. The AEDPA time bar doesn't apply because my client's injury wasn't apparent until October, or didn't occur until October 29th, 2009. to require Mr. Waddell to have filed
his grievance. What is he making in his grievance? It's on page, I don't see the page of the record here, 125, I guess it is. He filed a grievance on October 16, 2009.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's
Exhibit 10. What's that grievance about?
That grievance was him requesting to have all of his sentence reduction credits applied to his unconditional release date and him to be released.
How did he know that had not been done?
His lawyer wrote to him. He knew that that had not been done because he had not been given an unconditional release date by DOC.
Does he normally get that?
Inmates aren't updated on their unconditional release dates as a matter of course, but that is something that's available if they ask their programmer, which is a DOC employee. For Mr. Waddell to have known by April 27th, 1997, by the one-year deadline within HIPAA.
What did he know as of October 16, 2009?
He knew that there was some doubt based on the reactions that had been publicized in the media, the DOC.
He says, I'm to get all credits unless, I just can't read part of this. My copy is too bad.
I apologize for that. It's triplicate
Actually,
paper.
I would like to have a copy of that or to somebody type it up. You say he wrote that in response to information he received from his attorney?
Yes.
And what did his attorney tell him?
His attorney told him that based upon the ruling, I think that you were going to be released October 29th. That's what we were initially told.
I thought that was before Bowden. This is a week or 10 days before that, isn't it?
Well, the opinion was announced on October 9th, but the mandate didn't issue till the 29th.
All right.
But the point I'm getting to, I guess, is the limitations runs from the judgment date or from some kind of discovery, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. So
why isn't this date at least the date he knew about the problem?
October 9th? Yeah, an inmate wouldn't be entitled
October 16th.
October 16th.
2009.
Because his injury hadn't occurred yet. So that grievance...
He was denied good time credits. You think he has to wait until he's being released before? He can't challenge the denial of good time credits before then?
My reading of the case law is that such an action would be denied based on ripeness grounds. That prior to that, if he wanted
He's been denied, as of that time, he was denied good time credits, right? That's what his lawyer told him.
Well, I told him that he should grieve this process sort of in anticipation of litigation.
It seems to me if he's aware of the problem and he's not getting good time credits, he is now being hurt. The only injury isn't his release when he actually is being held beyond release. He can challenge the denial of good time credits while he's in prison, can't he?
He could if his only injury were that denial and a procedural due process action, he could possibly be foreclosed from relief.
Well, now, why wouldn't the 1 year start to run from October 16, 2009, in which case this would be late?
Because I believe that on October 29, 2009 is the date his actual injury accrued.
I'm assuming he's injured when he's denied the credits.
Assuming he's injured when he's denied
the credits. Yeah, his release date is not advanced because he was not being given credit. That's why he grieved it, isn't it? The prison system was not giving him an early release date.
Well, on that date, he didn't have a denial or an affirmative decision. What he wanted was information, and the grievance process is one way by which you can get that.
Is that what he says in there?
I don't know. I don't have Exhibit 10 in front of me, and I honestly...
You don't have the record there?
I have it right here. If you'd like, I can
get
it before...
Yeah, take a look at 125. Do it during for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. I'd like to do that.
Sure.
But I think that on that date, his injury as to a procedural due process question with a calculation of a sentence completion date may well have been time barred, but that's not the only injury that he's accrued. He's been injured.
Now, if the law always entitled him to good time credits from the beginning and was only rectified by Bowden, the district court concluded that because the law always was there, anybody looking at it could have looked at it the same way Bowden did, and the statute of limitations ran from back then.
Yes, and I think that allows the state to have its cake and eat it too.
Well, it never changed the law. The state never issued a new regulation. It never applied its good time credits differently until Bowdoin came down.
Until Bowdoin came down.
And Bowdoin wasn't looking at any change in the law. Bowdoin was looking at the law he was sentenced under.
Bowdoin corrected a fundamental misapprehension about the nature of Mr. Waddell's sentence.
Okay, and if it's that fundamental, then why isn't he charged with the same notice?
Well, he is, but he didn't have a denial of his 80-year sentence being treated like life until he wasn't released.
What did the OPUS show about his release date before his grievance?
I don't have that information. I requested it early on in litigation, was not able to get it from DOC. I can tell you that DOC's...
I thought it was 99999.
Well, that's what they say, but I don't... They say that that's what was entered because it was a life sentence, but it wasn't ever a life sentence.
Did he ever request a copy of his good time credits while he was in jail?
He did not, and I think that would be asking far more of due diligence than is reasonably to be expected of a prisoner.
Well, we have scads of cases from prisoners all over the Fourth Circuit that ask about their credits, and they don't get what they want, and they don't have any trouble filing hundreds of actions.
I believe you're speaking about the voluminous cases in the parole context, which is an admittedly different context. Parole is discretionary, and release.
Parole is they didn't get the credit that allowed them to move from one type of custody to another, mm-hmm. to move from one facility to another, to have more visitation. I mean, somebody's probably filing one right now.
Those scenarios deal with the sort of infringements upon liberty, which are typical with an incarcerative environment. And that's completely different than being held after your sentence has been expired. There are some deprivations which come with being convicted of a crime, and a prisoner gives up his liberty as to those when he's convicted. But a prisoner does not give up his liberty indefinitely when the state realizes that we thought you had a life sentence, we realize now you had an 80-year sentence, and rather than treat you like all other 80-year sentences, we'd like to retroactively fix what we wish the legislature had done in 1974. To do that, we'll sua sponte take away all of these credits, which there's no question that you've been earning. We'll decide that there's some distinction that's never before been an issue because we never before realized what the plain language of our law meant, and we'll now extend your sentence by 38 years. That the executive branch simply cannot do. That violates the ex post facto clause. And if you look at the exhibits in the record, there's several statements from the governor.
I thought that the Department of Corrections said that they did give your client these various credits for the purposes that they were used, that had he applied for parole or commutation by the governor, that these credits could have been applied and whenever along the line, in the 80s, the 90s.
That theory came up during the Jones v. Keller litigation, and it had never been, to my knowledge, propounded by the DOC before. And the dissent in Jones v. Keller points out that despite coming up with this, agreeing with the DOC's theory, the majority found that Mr. Jones was sentenced to a determinate term of 80 years, that he'd earned good time, gain time, and merit time credits pursuant to the regulations, that he had over 14,000 of those days, that under DOC's regulations, those days couldn't be forfeited except good time credits, which can be forfeited, but only by wrongdoing, major infractions, which comes with attendant notice and hearing procedures. And under DOC's own regulations, those sentence reduction credits operate to reduce the length of an inmate sentence. And the regulations do not specify or limit the purposes for which the credits are awarded. So the conclusion that follows from that is that these credits should be applied to do what sentence reduction credits do, reduce the sentence. The conclusion that follows is not these credits don't matter. I believe the reason that they get to that idea, that the credits don't matter, is this idea of a de minimis liberty interest, which doesn't exist anywhere in established federal constitutional law. Instead, a prisoner's interest in being free from incarceration at the completion of his sentence is elemental, it's fundamental, and it's not something which can be balanced away. The balancing the Supreme Court engaged in is some sort of novel thing. To me, it looks like the substantive due process balancing test that you engage in when you're challenging a legislative action. If you want to engage in the substantive due process test here.
The court you're talking about now is the North Carolina Supreme Court?
Yes, Your Honor. The North Carolina Supreme Court in Jones versus Keller. I believe the correct substantive due process test here is the one that applies to executive actions, which is a shocks the conscience standard, which is when something is done not merely negligently, but is willful and is done to oppress a given a person or a population. And I think if you look at the statements made by the governor and the DOC that are in the exhibits, specifically exhibits 14, 15, and 16, where you read that the way inmates were told they were no longer going home was the prison administrators were to read the governor's press release to them where she said she was appalled and doing everything legally possible to keep them incarcerated. I think that shocks the conscience. And the dissent, Justices Timmons Goodson and Rob Hudson of the North Carolina Supreme Court agree with me. As to the ex post facto claim, I think it's pretty straightforward. You cannot change the rules of the game when you're 37 years in.
Who changed the rules?
The DOC, by deciding on on November 16th, 2009, by saying, from this point forward, even though your sentence is 80 years, we're going to pretend it's still a life sentence and no longer apply credits to you. I see my time has expired.
But the Jones case said they didn't change the rules.
They did. And I believe that conclusion is simply not supported by the facts.
I'm curious about this. They did change the rules. When did they change them?
November 16th. I want to make sure I have that date right. The governor's press release was November 19th.
Well, that's in favor of the defendant. They changed it because the court said so.
It's not.
But they didn't change it. They never changed, issued a new regulation or changed a practice or changed the statute.
That's not necessary in order to provide, in order to consist of an ex post facto violation. It's not the language per se, it's the effect. And the effect is to lengthen Mr. Waddell's sentence by almost 43 years.
What was his sentence under the practices being followed before Bowdoin?
Before Bowdoin, his sentence was 80 years, subject to reduction by the sentence reduction credits. I don't think the state should get credit for having the sentence reduction credits correct prior to Bowdoin and the sentence length wrong.
Why do you say it was why the law was like Bowdoin said the whole time? Why do you, Bowdoin was nothing new then?
Well, the North Carolina court said in Bowdoin that this is a clear, unambiguous statute. So that's why I say that it was clear.
Well, then why isn't he charged with notice of an unambiguous statute?
He is charged with notice of the statute,
well,
but I don't think he has
to. He had the benefits all the way, the limitations, and would go all the way back to his date of judgment.
I don't think the limitations, may I answer? I'm sorry, I'm well
oh,
over
please.
My time. I don't think the limitations go back to his date of judgment. With all due respect.
The district court found, right?
Yes, and I think that position is incorrect, because that would have the effect of keeping inmates from challenging their execution of their sentences so long as they were convicted prior to the effective date of AEDPA. In other words, if you were to have to file within 1 year of your judgment or within 1 year of AEDPA, I believe that you'd always be kicked out on ripeness grounds because this your injury isn't acute yet. The entitlement to having the DOC give you, you know, an appropriate.
You're telling me that you can't challenge the failure to award good time credits before you before the release date that you're claiming.
No, Your Honor, with all due respect, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if AEDPA is read to require you to do that
Let's get the principle straight then. If a prison says you're not getting good time credits today,
mm-hmm.
and he's still got 30 years to go, says today you're not going to get good time credits, can he challenge that with a habeas?
He could, but that is not this case. If Mr. Waddell had asked, he would have been told, of course you're earning credits, but your sentence is life.
No, he would have been told, that's right, life, and the good time credits are only for parole.
They're for parole, they're for these other things, and the reason they're not to advance your unconditional release date is because in our system, we treat life like infinity. You can't make,
right.
You know, that's a mathematical impossibility.
Well, if they treat them that way, but you were saying that there's a little bit, we're looking at this differently. You say Bowdoin said it was unambiguous. And anybody looking at that could have figured it out. Well, if that's so, and he was not being getting credit advancing his release time, but they were treating it as infinity, then he's being denied a right that he otherwise had, and he could raise it at any time. And that's what the district court found. If you take the conclusion, well, it was too sophisticated, he couldn't figure it out, then you look at his grievance on October 16, which was still a year before he filed, more than a year before he filed, And there he's saying, I'm to get, he says my release date is October 29, and they didn't, I'm to get all credits. Anyway, he's talking about what he's to get, which is basically to get it against his release date. Now, if that's so, then the clock, if it's discovery date, then the clock should start at least by then, because that reveals he knows the problem.
Well, he's not denied anything then, though. I don't think you can read the grievance that way.
Your argument is that he's denied it when he's not let out of jail. That's it.
Yes, Your Honor. Because
is that the law?
I think the law is that the vital facts trigger the discovery date.
What?
The vital facts that go to...
Yeah, but that, see, you're not answering my question then. When someone is in jail and is denied a good time credit that he otherwise thinks he should be getting, he can raise it right then, and you agreed with me.
He could raise it right then, but he wasn't. I just disagree with you that Mr. Waddell was there.
I'm not getting my good time credits on October 16. Now, if he's saying I'm not getting my good time credits, he's recognizing that the state has denied him good time credits. And he can bring it up.
Well, I don't believe that grievance can be considered completed until you get a response from it and take it through the other steps.
No, I'm talking about knowledge.
You're talking about.
He's stuck with a 1-year limitation from the date of his judgment, or because you know this judgment was earlier in this day, much later still from what 97, from April 97, but. It also says the only other saving grace you get is it's 1 year from the date of discovery, isn't it? What's
yes.
what's the limitation you're relying on? What section?
2244 D1D.
D1 or 2?
D1.
You're saying it runs from October 29th?
Yes, Your Honor.
Of which was when Bowdoin became final.
That's when Bowdoin became final. That's when he should have been released.
That's your position.
That's my position.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's hear the state's position.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will be addressing the statute of limitations issue, and Mr. Dilforge will address the underlying claim. Judge Meemeyer, you hit the nail on the head when you said that Mr. Waddell had the same notice in this case that Mr. Bowdoin did, and both of their actions accrued in the late 1970s. After they received a life sentence, they were on notice of that statute, 14-2. At that time, neither Mr. Bowdoin or Mr. Waddell were earning good time credits to reduce their sentence. For that,
how did they know that?
Well, the statute was on the books. They.
I know, but the statute didn't tell them that it wouldn't accrue. The statute said your sentence is 80 years.
Well, they knew they weren't accruing them to get out at that point, Your Honor. We know
the good time or the credits all rose under regulation.
Yes, sir. And we know from the Jones case, which both parties agree is the governing state court adjudication here. We know from the Jones case, I believe it's finding of fact number 7 in the North Carolina Superior Court order, that at that time, the sentences were entered as 9999 life, gain time, good time, meritorious crime credits were not reducing these sentences. So at that time, the claim accrued. So petitioner had until April 24th, according to this court's case law, April 24th, 1997, to bring his claim. He did not do that, and he is therefore 13 years late in bringing his claim.
Was it always that 9999999?
Yes, sir, from the very beginning.
Never changed. It was always that.
Absolutely. That was the way it was entered. I think it's also a good point to look at this grievance by Mr. Waddell. And what we can read of it, I believe it's on page 125 of the joint appendix. What we can read on it, Mr. Waddell quotes
how
that.
How can we read it?
What we can read.
Can somebody provide us, can the two of you agree on what it says and provide us within a week?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We will work together to get a legible copy of this. But from what we can read of it, we see that he has quoted the statute. He says GS 14-2. He talks about not getting his release date and they're not being applied. And then when we compare this, what we can read of this, granted, with Mr. Bowden's pro se petition from December 2005, it sounds very similar to me. Mr. Bowden, this is on page 724 of the record. We see he's talking about, that's the page that his petition starts. He talks about that statute. He talks about his credits. He talks about not having them applied. He talks about how this statute should be applied according to what the North Carolina Court of Appeals would eventually find in Mr. Bowden's case. So Mr. Waddell had the same legal tools, the same factual predicate existed for him that existed for Mr. Bowden, and both those cases, the federal habeas case should have been brought by April 24, 2007.
1997, you mean?
Yeah, excuse me, 1997. Thank you, Your Honor.
You mean 1997. But then that's your first position.
Yes, sir.
What's your fallback position on the discovery rule?
On our interpretation of...
The next position you have.
The interpretation of 2244D1D, is that the discovery of the claim?
On the time bar.
On the time bar, yes, Your Honor.
Say we don't agree with you on the 1997 date.
Well, I think even if you go, we too agree that 2244D1D is the accrual date. It would just have accrued with the factual predicate, the legal tools were in existence in the 1970s. And I think it is a complete misstatement of the law to say that 2244D1D awaits, you know, some sort of ripeness to the point that someone is to be released. That is a complete misstatement of law. There is no case out there that says this. I think the district court summarized the case law, and he summarized it very well. I believe it was on page, joint appendix page 906. He says this does not await the point at which these claims become manifest. So it would not have awaited the Bowden decision. It certainly would not have awaited the day he felt like he should be released. We know from this court's case law in Wade v. Robinson, we know that case told us it was when it was available through public sources. That's what we had here. We had a statute. We had the way that he was not earning any time credits to lower the length of his sentence in the late 1970s. He should have brought this claim on April 24th, 1997.
You still didn't answer my question.
Yes, sir.
What's your alternative claim? What's your next date? Say we don't agree with you on that.
You don't agree with us that April 24th, 1997 was the accrual date?
If you don't.
Well, I mean, certainly...
And what's his next date? Is there another...
Judge Niemeyer...
What about D1D? You didn't address that.
2244D1D?
Yeah. That it says the date on which the factual predicate of the claim or claims presented could have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. That particular accrual date is not when this case is absolutely right. That's not when we have the Bowden decision. The factual predicate for this case was discoverable through due diligence in the late 1970s, where you have the statute 14-2, and you have the fact that he is not earning any gain time to reduce his sentence.
Grievance? Are you making any argument that the grievance letter...
She's not making any argument about that. She's saying it's 1997, and that's it.
Your Honor, I will say that that is when, you know, you could argue that the grievance is when he actually had notice of it. It's not an actual notice statute. It's a statute of when...
They're asking you friendly questions.
I realize, Your Honor, they're asking me friendly questions. And
the grievance is good enough for you.
The grievance is good enough, Your Honor. It is October 16th.
It could have been discovered by due diligence.
Yes,
and
sir.
If he discovered it by the time of his grievance, that ends the question.
It would end the question. That would be a good alternative. That would be a sufficient alternative for the state's purpose. But we have maintained all along it should have been April 24th, 1997. I completely realize that. That would certainly work in this case.
I think that's what Judge King was trying to ask you, if that's part of your argument.
Absolutely, we would certainly accept if the court found that. But I'm arguing what we have consistently argued.
We're not talking about finding, really. We're just talking about what.
Yeah, we're not making findings.
Yes, Your Honor.
Either one of those, you would be right that it's time barred.
Yes, in this particular case, correct.
Now, I'll address the final question about this. Is the petitioner says that you couldn't bring a habeas until there's actual injury by not being released.
Well, I think that would just defeat the statute of limitations. It would defeat the statute of limitations in lots of cases.
Of the AEDPA limitations run in that regard.
Absolutely. None of those four accrual dates listed in 2244D1 give you that option. And in fact, that reading of any one of those would defeat the statute of limitations. If someone is being held beyond, you know, the sentence, it would defeat the statute of limitations in a lot of administrative cases. A lot of these cases where they allege good time gain time credit are not being properly applied. And as Judge Agee pointed out, I do almost exclusively non-capital federal habeas cases, and it has been my experience these inmates are well aware of the applications of their time credits and when they should have been released. And so, Your Honors, if you don't have any more questions, we would ask that you affirm the district court's decision that this case was barred by the statute of limitations.
All right, we'll hear from you, Mr. DelForge.
The decision of the North Carolina Supreme Court was objectively reasonable.
You're talking about
in this case, in Jones versus Keller, which is the controlling state court opinion here. It's objectively reasonable. It's neither contrary to nor an unreasonable application of U.S. Supreme Court precedent. There is no precedent which mandates that these good time, gain time credits be used to reduce their unconditional release dates on a life sentence. The cases the petitioner cites are Wolf versus McDonald, a due process case. That case involved revocation of good time, gain time credits in a prison disciplinary proceeding and what sort of procedures that were required before you could take those away. In this case, as Judge Niemeyer said, there was nothing taken away from these inmates. From the very first of all, this inmate got the death sentence initially. And then when that was overturned, he got a life sentence in 1976.
Your Honor? It's immaterial.
Well,
he got a life sentence.
Right. He got a life sentence in 1976. From the first good time credit he earned in 1976 all the way up till the ones he's earning today have always been applied for the same three purposes: for custody status, for possible parole eligibility, and possible commutation by the governor. Nothing has been taken away from him. It's always been consistently applied from day one in 1976 till March 23rd of 2012. It's always been the same. He has a life sentence. Admittedly, the Bowden court construed life sentence to be 80 years, but it did not change the fact that he received a life sentence. And the Jones versus Keller case emphasizes that. As a matter of state law, these inmates received life sentences. They're first-degree murderers. They got a life sentence, just like life sentences imposed in other cases, except for the little niche of time that they were under. A life sentence was, quote, considered 80 years.
What happened to Bowden when Jones came out?
Well, Bowden only construed 14-2, okay? Bowden did not determine how good time, gain time credits were to apply to those life sentences.
Well, except it did say for all purposes, isn't that what it said? 80 years for all purposes.
That's true, but that's the North Carolina Court of Appeals. It can't be read
I understand,
in a vacuum.
That's what it said. And
right.
I think it does read broader than just 14.2. It now tells them they have to treat the 80 years for all purposes.
That is correct. But then the North Carolina Supreme Court clarified that matter as it applies to the good
Jones
time.
So Jones was a clarification.
Yes, is objectively reasonable. It's objectively reasonable under Wolf on the due process issue. It's objectively reasonable on the ex post facto clause under Lentz v. Mathis and Weaver v. Graham. Both of those cases are clearly distinguishable because in Lentz you had inmates who had already been released. They had a prison overcrowding problem in Florida, and so they had lots of good time, gain time credits were given to release a lot of inmates. Then 11 years later, the Florida legislature says, oh no, we don't like this, we're going to revoke those good time credits and bring those inmates and put them back in prison, and that's what they did. And that was taking something away from the inmates that they had already earned. That was an ex post facto violation. Here, nothing has ever been taken away from these inmates that they had earned. Not from day one. These inmates had no expectation, no reasonable expectation of release at any time. For 30 years, they had no expectation of any unconditional release date at all. It was only until Bowden came along that this issue arose. And the Weaver versus Graham is another ex post facto case. In that case, the Florida General Assembly had a 5, 10, and 15 day good time, gain time scheme that was reduced to a 3, 6, 9 scheme per month. And it applied to prior convictions. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, that's an ex post facto violation, because it took away something that those inmates had at the time they were convicted. Here, there was no taking away. These men had no...
I guess her argument is that he assumed that he was getting good time credits until Bowden raised an issue about it. He was getting good time credits because the statute said he should get them.
But he knew from day one on the record that his life, his unconditional release date was 99999 from day one. And that was a finding of fact by the trial court judge in the Jones v. Keller case. There were three cases, as a matter of fact, that found that. Two different Superior Court judges specifically found. And those were one of the judges went the other way on that issue, you know, and ordered them to be released. But they all still found that those inmates knew from the very beginning, from DOC records, that they had no unconditional release date. So there was nothing that was taken away from them. You know, these inmates have consistently received the good time, gain time credits for the purposes for which they were originally awarded. Nothing has been taken away from them. The district court properly found the petition was time barred, and it properly upheld the decision on the merits, and would ask this court to affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Barbara? On the statute of limitations issue, do you have any case that says that the habeas petition cannot be brought until his release date?
I do not have that case, and I believe the reason is because this is a very unique situation.
No, there are always fights about release dates. I mean, we get a lot of cases about people saying the state made an error, misapplied them, fights about them, and my recollection is, may not be perfect, but my recollection is that we get the habeas, or they challenge them either through 1983, which they shouldn't because it's a habeas type of thing, but we get those types of challenges while they're still in prison because it affects their release date, and they're ripe for adjudication because the determination was made.
I believe those cases sound under D1A because they're typically charged, and again, I haven't read every single case in the Fourth Circuit.
Well, where in the limitations statute in 2244 do we even introduce the notion of injury for a habeas?
I wasn't trying to say that it's in the context of the statute, and if that's how it sounded to the court,
well,
I apologize.
It's
got to
be. We're talking about a limitations issue, statute of limitations, mm-hmm. created by 2244, which is for habeas corpus, governs 2254, and you've got to satisfy that. Come under one of them because the issue's been raised by the state that it's untimely. Mm-hmm. And I don't know which clause you come under, but the question, I guess, is raised by the state now, is there's no notion that injury has to be sustained. or ripeness. There's not a notion of ripeness. The idea is when you have a federal court reviewing a state court proceeding, they want it cut off pretty quickly. 1 year, and that's it.
I think that that's true, but in this case, the 1 year should run from the date he wasn't released. On October 16th, the date he filed this grievance, or on October 19th,
the
date it was received.
What's the language that you're relying on?
It's the language about the date the facts were discoverable.
All right, that's D.
Yes.
D1D. And that D1D says reasonably could have been discovered, right? It says the date on which the factual predicate of the claim or claims presented could have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence. It doesn't talk about injury or ripeness. It talks about discovery.
And
we know he discovered this at least as early as the time of his grievance, right?
I think you should look at the grievance and say he's relying upon the advice of his lawyer who's saying there's a chance this couldn't go correctly.
But then it's even greater because his lawyer is telling him there's a problem. But the question is, did he have knowledge of the facts then that would give rise to filing a petition?
He had
knowledge. And the whole reason for the grievance was to lay the groundwork for the petition, wasn't it?
It was thinking about, honestly, a 1983 action. But he had notice in the form of the political upheaval, the news coverage, and so on and so forth. What he didn't have was an affirmative statement from the DOC that you're not going to be getting out. And that's the fact. That's the discoverable fact.
Why is he saying then my release date should be October 29, 09, and my good time credits, to get all credits. I mean, that's what he's saying in there. I'm to get all credits. What's he complaining about?
Well, he's saying I think you take that at face value. He wants all of his credits so that he can be released on the 29th. But he's not complaining here, I didn't get my credits. He's complaining, I didn't get released. And that just didn't happen.
Don't you think that reveals that he has discovered the predicate facts of his claim?
Should
have discovered them at that point?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I think
what didn't he know then?
He didn't know that he wasn't going to be released. And I think that to read it the other way allows the state to have it both ways, right? This was, you should have brought your claim in the 1970s, but we didn't know until 2009. You had no expectation of release, but you had an expectation of release in the 1970s, and so you should have filed, far earlier. I think the way to harmonize these things is to recognize that AEDPA doesn't exist in a vacuum. And AEDPA, I'm not really honestly sure that AEDPA is best suited to be applied to challenges to the execution of sentences because of this difficulty, because it seems to foreclose all challenges to that.
Thanks, Ms. Farber. And I do want to recognize that you're court-appointed. That's a very important service, and we value that very much.
Thank you very much.
Yes, we'll come down and greet counsel, then proceed on to the last case.
Thank you.